Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
Hi, my name is Robin Wigglesworth. I'm a journalist with the Financial Times. But I'm glad to say that Simon has relinquished his normal seat for a few episodes to allow me to dig into one of my favorite subjects, quantitative investing, and how it's reshaping asset management and markets more broadly. Now, I'm glad to have an excellent guest with me today to explore the fascinating field known as multi-factor investing. And welcome Savina Rizova, Global Head of Research at Dimensional Fund Advisors.
Hi, Robin. Glad to be here.
Savina was recently named as one of the 100 most influential women in US finance by the magazine Barron's. She was nominated by none other than Robert Merton, the Nobel laureate in economics. He described Savina as the standout in more than 50 years of him working with some of the best quantitative analysts and investors in the field. That's quite an endorsement given Merton's standing. And given where Savina works, you know, Dimensional Fund Advisors, an investment group that manages nearly $680 billion in systematic stock and bond portfolios. So DFA, or Dimensional, was founded by some of the pioneers of the indexing industry, David Booth and Rex Sinquefield, and has always had a deep roster of impressive financial economists as advisors, from Merton himself to Gene Farmer and Ken French, his current godfathers. Rex, David, and the others that Savina's worked with have gone far beyond diversified low-cost index portfolios and added flexibility in the daily implementation of which stocks and bonds to hold. So I'm pretty thrilled that she's here today and to get stuck into what I personally think is one of the most exciting corners of the investment industry. Taking a step back a little bit, I mean, I know you're from Bulgaria, right? I don't imagine a lot of people in Bulgaria grow up dreaming of becoming a quantitative analyst or a financial analyst. Like, how did you end up at Dimensional?
Both my parents have a master's in economics. So I grew up with some economics books at home. And I quickly realized I do want to study more economics. When I was in high school, I won a scholarship to do a summer program in the US. So I went to Choate Rosemary Hall on the East Coast, where I took an economics class that summer, and I really loved it. And so then I applied to US colleges, and I got into Dartmouth College, where I was economics education and math major. And at Dartmouth, I started being a research assistant for Professor Kenneth French, who is at Tuck Business School at Dartmouth. And at some point, as I was sharing with him my plans to pursue a PhD in finance, Ken suggested that I get some real life experience before I go do my PhD. And he mentioned that he consults with that firm. This was back in 2003, based in Santa Monica, California, called Dimensional Fund Advisors. So I flew out to LA from the East Coast and met with the research team at Dimensional and really liked the people and the research they were doing, the types of projects they were engaged in, and decided to follow Ken's advice and take a job at Dimensional. This is what I ended up doing for 3 years, and then pursued my PhD at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. And then decided, you know what? I really love what I've been doing at Dimension. I can do it now even better with more skills. So I ended up going back to Dimension in 2011. And that's how I ended up here now, Global Head of Research.
I know that you're a petrol head, that you're a Formula One fan. I have to ask why. And is that a common interest among financial analysts and people at Dimensional?
Yes, a big fan of Formula One, thanks to my husband. He made me a big fan many years ago. We've been to a lot of races in Austin, Texas, where Dimensional is headquartered, but also in Monaco and Melbourne. And I have to tell you that there are quite a few parallels you can draw between success in Formula One racing and success in systematic investing. The first obvious one is you need expertise in design, in both of designing portfolios and designing the cars for the race. But then also, you need cutting-edge technology, both in systematic investing and in F1. Cutting-edge technology to run your processes as efficiently as possible, but also to efficiently process huge amounts of data in real time. For example, at Dimensional, every day we compute expected returns on thousands of secure bonds. We kind of create a lot of thousands of breakpoints for our portfolios, et cetera. You need a lot of investment data to process that and generate those breakpoints, those expected returns. Similarly, in Formula One, during a race, they consume a lot of telemetry from the cars in real time and weather information. And so that is another parallel. And finally, in both, you need human oversight and flexibility to succeed as well. In systematic investing, you need the flexibility to face events like COVID or the war in Ukraine in a robust manner. And in F1 racing, you need that flexibility in human oversight to be able to react to an unexpected thunderstorm or a car crash in the middle of the race, which would trigger a change in your strategy. So lots of commonalities between F1 and systematic investing.
Well, that's interesting. I'm convinced then. So Samina, maybe let's start with an easy one. What really is quantitative investing or systematic investing or multi-factor investing? And where does Dimensional fit into this fairly broad spectrum?
Well, Robin, you said broad spectrum. Absolutely. There are so many different flavors of quantitative systematic investing that it's very hard to give a succinct definition of what this represents. So let me help you and our audience position where Dimensional is within that very broad spectrum. As you mentioned, our founders helped start some of the earliest index funds out there, but then they realized that you can actually do better than indexing, go beyond indexing with structured investing by seeking to add value in every step of the investment process. It starts with how you're going to build the portfolio, the strategy design, to portfolio management, and then trading, how you execute your buy and sell orders to change the holdings in the portfolio. And so at Dimensional, what we seek to do is add value at every step of that process. First, identify reliable long-term drivers of returns that we want to build our portfolios around. Then think of what are the ways in which we can add value in portfolio management by daily monitoring the portfolio and evaluating the trade-offs between premiums, costs to achieve those premiums, to pursue those premiums, diversification, and use information in current real-time market prices to evaluate those trade-offs every day.
That first day at Dimensional, when Ken French sent you over there, you said you liked the people, you liked the place. Why?
All the people I met when I first visited Dimensional were very smart, hardworking, but also passionate about what they were doing in finance. When you hear about it, it kind of clicks in your mind and say, yeah, that's the way you should be investing, because you are kind of taking the best of both worlds, the best of passive, broad diversification, as you said, low cost transparency, but also the best of active in the sense of pursuit of higher expected returns and kind of daily use of information in market prices to adjust your portfolio and flexible trading. Why not combine the two?
Well, I remember seeing once that Rex Sinkfield, one of the founders, called himself the Ayatollah of efficient markets. I guess like Gene Farmer must be the god of efficient markets then. But that seems to be a very strong part of DFA's culture, that everybody I've talked to have worked there or knows the place talks about how strong the culture is, that it's very, some people really believe in this. And they have these little training sessions that everybody has to go to. If you're a financial advisor that wants to sell Dimensional products, you have to go to these training sessions. How is that maintained? Can you work there and not believe markets are efficient?
Dimensional's investment philosophy and approach, as you say, is deeply based on a belief in markets and competitive markets and the power of market prices. We believe that in competitive markets, prices quickly incorporate new information and reflect the aggregate expectations of market participants. And not only do we believe that, but we actually use information embedded in current market prices throughout the investment process, both when it comes to equities and fixed income. As a researcher at Dimensional, it's been so pleasant for me to see the confirmation of that belief and that power of competitive capital markets in so many different types of markets. Obviously, there's been a lot of research in equity markets, for example, showing that when there's like news, stock prices react, right? Similarly, there have been studies in the bond market, but when you start doing it more systematically, for example, looking at market prices yields, the equivalent in bond markets and their relation to expected future bond returns, you see that strong relation, not just in government bonds where the initial research was treasuries, but you also see then in corporate bonds.
So you see this in so many different corners of markets being replicated again and again. That reaffirms your belief in it. That makes sense. I definitely want to dive into the fixed income side because I think there's a lot of interesting things going on there. But what about systematic investing? Is it that appeals to you personally? Like you said, you studied economics, you liked mathematics, you liked investing. These are all skills or interests that could have seen you land in many corners of Wall Street. Why systematic investing? Why Dimensional? And why you?
I love systematic investing because it's the most reliable and efficient way of investing. If you take a step back, historically, people started investing actively. That was the first way of investing. And after many years of investing actively and lots of studies showing the inability to systematically outguess market prices, there has been a big shift to indexing. But then I think we are slowly realizing with lots of studies in the last 10, 20 years showing that there are also rigidities associated with indexing, unnecessary rigidities that can be avoided if you are investing in a more intelligent manner, more flexible manner. And that flexible daily implementation is something that's at the heart of how we invest at Dimensional. And that's what we call or define as systematic active.
So it's kind of a sliding scale or a spectrum of systematic, where pure indexing is systematic. It's just kind of dumb and simple and basic in systematic investing. And then you move towards a fully sort of discretionary artisanal way. Dimensional fits more towards the systematic side, but still wants to be opportunistic and thoughtful about how it does that. Is that it?
Yes. Another way we define how we invest is thoughtful implementation of sensible ideas.
Well, Dimensional started off doing essentially what would be now known as a microcap index strategy. But of course, there were no real microcap or even small cap indices at the time. There was no term for microcaps. And frankly, even these factors, whether it's size or value and these things, weren't really sort of fully fleshed out at the time. How has the firm evolved over the decades since that first fledgling microcap index fund?
Yes. So our first strategy was a microcap strategy designed to provide exposure to those tiny stocks to institutional investors back in 1981. After that, we launched more strategies focused on the small cap space that, again, were trying to deliver exposure to that space in a value-added systematic manner. And then in the early 90s, we expanded on the equity size to incorporate the brand new back then research from Fama and French on the value premium that, along with the size premium, were major drivers of stock returns, in addition, obviously, to the market premium. And after that, I would say for two decades, probably, we mainly focused on size and value with one major evolution in 2005, which was the launch of our core equity portfolios, which blended basically the focus on size and value premiums. And then in 2012-13, we adopted a third main long-term driver of stock returns in our portfolios, what others might call quality, but we call the profitability premium. And then since then, I would say the next big milestone was the incorporation of investment premium, the fifth factor in the Fama French new five-factor model. This was in 2019, 2020. We moved into the ETF space with systematic active equity ETFs.
Well, I definitely want to go deeper into, but well, certainly the ETF side, but also fixed income. But maybe this is something that I have to admit, sometimes I get confused about. But the terms like risk premium, risk factors, smart beta, what are the difference? Are they all the name for the same thing? I mean, what are these things? And what is the right way of thinking about them?
So this is where our conversation is going to get very nerdy. So I apologize in advance.
I love nerdy conversations.
Stay with us for the next 5 minutes. But you're right. There are lots of terms being thrown out there. And actually, they do mean different things from a proper science, asset pricing, finance standpoint. The simplest one probably to understand is factors. And it is misused, but the proper definition of a factor is typically a portfolio or a basket of securities where you are kind of long one set of stocks, let's say, and short another set of stocks. And that basket represents the aims to capture the co-movement of groups of stocks with similar characteristics. So an industry factor or a country factor or a style factor. What is usually misperceived about factors is that not every factor out there has to have a positive or expected return, a premium. Whereas risk factors are factors that are motivated by usually theoretical financial models, and those factors come with a positive reward because they are a representation of some broad, systematic, non-diversifiable risk that typically exposure to that risk is compensated with a risk premium. Not every factor is likely to pay off with a positive return.
No. And smart beta, what the heck does that mean? Is that just a marketing term?
It's a great marketing term, but what it has come to reflect is investing to pursue some factors out there. And by the way, there is a whole zoo of factors out there that has appeared in the last couple of decades, at least. And smart beta is a way to provide exposure to many of those factors. Big challenge with smart beta is that while it can provide in an index or systematic way exposure to those factors, as we just said, not all factors are expected to come with positive expected returns, which means that smart beta doesn't necessarily lead to higher performance of a strategy in the long term. You have to be really careful. There's a zoo of factors, but only a few of them, in our opinion, are reliable long-term drivers of returns.
Speaking of the factor zoo, I mean, I've spoken to Professor Campbell Harvey about this. You know, he's a former editor of the Journal of Finance, and he thinks that a lot of the various premia that have been discovered over the years by various researchers are essentially just massive amounts of data mining. That in the publish or die world of academic finance, you just have to find something to justify all the work you're doing and get published. So there's always tempting to sort of massage the data or the time frame that you use to find something that is interesting that gets you published, but in reality is just bunkum. Do you think that is as big a problem as he maintains in sort of financial economics?
Yes, I think definitely we've seen a lot of proliferation of different factors and smart beta strategies because of that attempt to identify new, interesting, shiny objects out there that can potentially contribute to a better investment performance. But the reality is that we don't expect there to be many long-term drivers of returns.
Speaking of research, and you're the head of research as well, one thing that has always fascinated me, and maybe is the biggest difference between maybe how the outside world sees things, is that they think quant or systematic investing is black box and you switch a machine on and then you go to the beach, as it were. You don't have to iterate all the time. But Dimensional, of course, believes in these timeless factors that are kind of rooted in human behavior and what we're like as people. But presumably still, like, things have evolved quite a lot over the just the course of your career, right? How has it changed in those 10, 20 years now? And how do you think it's going to change in the next 20 years as well? Because as much as maybe the core framework is there, how much change is constantly involved in tweaking and updating these models in a practical sense?
The one thing I love about the emission is that the philosophy is very stable and the philosophy hasn't evolved. Meaning we do believe that in public competitive capital markets, prices incorporate a lot of information. And as I mentioned, that has been confirmed over and over again in many different types of research we and others have conducted. The trends that I've seen or changes in recent times that are likely to persist in the future, the next 10, 20 years, are one, obviously now the big push into active transparent ETFs. And we've been the pioneers there, the leaders there. That's one big trend. The other big trend is the trend towards personalization. So delivering investment solutions in a highly personalized manner through separately managed accounts.
Staying with the direct investing or direct indexing and personalized investing, I hear a lot about that. And obviously, there have been many acquisitions in the space from a Vanguard and a BlackRock, Morgan Stanley and Franklin Templeton. You guys decided to build that. I mean, why is that? And why is there so much attention around this? Why is there so much confidence that this is a huge new thing?
There is a global cross-industry trend for personalization, from personalizing technology use for personalizing what you watch at night on the couch to how you play video games to how you invest. And so there is more and more demand for putting your personal, social, environmental, governance considerations, values, concerns, expressing them through how you invest. So there's one big reason why personalization is a big trend in investing as well. The other one, which has been with us for a while, is obviously the desire to have more tailored to your particular needs, tax management in the account. And while that need has been with us for many, many years, it's the evolvement of technology that is enabling now us to deliver kind of institutional level quality daily portfolio management in an SMA. Last year, we had a soft launch in June and a broad launch in September. There has been a lot of uptake of the solution because people really love being able to access the dimensional way of investing in something that's actually quite sleek from a technological perspective and very easy to launch, manage, monitor. So far, over $350 million have been put in those lower minimum SMAs. Over 150-160 accounts have been launched, and it's been less than 6 months since broad launch. So very happy for to satisfy that demand for personalized investing and working to further expand the options, of course.
Well, speaking of that menu and the delivery mechanisms, ETFs, obviously a subject that I love talking about. It's still interesting to see systematic active strategies get wrapped up into ETFs now. And you guys were not early in that, but obviously have had a lot of success very quickly. I'd be interested in hearing why you didn't get into ETFs earlier and why you now have decided to go into it in a fairly big way as well. What's the rationale behind that?
Our general philosophy for launching new investment solutions is that we launch them when there's a strong, well-identified market demand for them, when the investment proposition behind the solution makes sense, and when we see ourselves as able to provide sustainable long-term value add in that solution. The third key thing is where ETFs were failing for us for a long time. Why? Because for a long time, ETF just didn't allow for the incorporation of that systematic yet flexible implementation that we see as our key value add. But things changed. In September of 2019, the SEC adopted that well-known ETF rule. What it made possible is for us to be able to have a lot of flexibility in how we rebalance our portfolios within an ETF wrapper by using those custom create and redeem baskets every day. And as soon as that rule passed, we started working on preparing the launch of our first ETFs in 2020. And then since then, we converted several tax-managed mutual funds into ETFs, and then launched a few active, transparent fixed income ETFs. And last month, we launched a few U.S.-focused ETFs, and we're about to launch a few more like next week.
Well, that's fascinating. Yeah, no, I'd only belatedly sort of cotton onto it. I knew the SEC rule when it came, and it was interesting. It's a big deal. But the details of that was fascinating. So this is interesting. So what is the advantage of selling your strategies through ETFs? Why did you jump into this door when it finally opened up? What are the attractions of an ETF as opposed to very long-established U.S. 40 Act mutual funds, for example?
The mutual funds and ETFs can do very many things in the same way. A few distinctions between them are that ETFs obviously can be traded during the day, throughout the day on an exchange. So that gives just more flexibility as to when you can transition between cash and ETF or stocks and ETFs. And that's one appeal of using ETFs rather than mutual funds. And of course, with ETFs in the US market, just like with stocks, you have typically at major custodians, no commission trading. So that it was like a major appeal versus some mutual funds do incur charges when bought or sold. And so for investors who are consistently adding to their investments over time, wanting to avoid those recurring charges is important. The other obvious advantage of ETFs when it comes to capital gains is that the create redeem mechanism enables ETFs to minimize the realization of capital gains in a portfolio and defer the payment of capital gains to when the actual ETF is liquidated.
With this new SEC rule and the European, there's something similar. I'm fascinated by the evolution of the ETF, and most people, including me initially, always thought of it as an index fund because that's how it was born. That was its genesis, isn't it? A passive fund. Do you think we are now starting to see the evolution of the ETF into a far broader, more powerful fund wrapper that will eventually supplant the mutual fund? Because of these advantages, whether it's in distribution, no commissions, tax advantages in the US?
Yes, with this new SEC rule definitely has opened the gate to a lot more systematic, active, not just index ETFs, strategies launching under the ETF format. We are likely to see much more of that in the next few years. That's for sure.
Returning to something you've kind of led some breadcrumbs along our conversation about, but systematic fixed income, which is one of the more fascinating topics for me, at least inside the systematic world, because I kind of feel that has never received the same attention. I mean, systematic equity investing has kind of been around since, you know, David Booth and Rex Sinkfield and the first index funds, basically since the 70s. That's been a vibrant field. Fixed income, not quite the same. But when I've talked to people in that field, discretionary active managers, they quite often scoff at the idea that a lot of these stupid behavioral glitches that causes long-term factor performance in the equity landscape exist in fixed income. They say, well, we have our own behavioral issues around, for example, ratings. But broadly speaking, fixed income investors have always been more cynical, more mathematical, more rigorous than stupid people in equities. That's how they see it, right? I think that's not entirely untrue, actually. that bond investors are pretty good, whether it was the prop desks of yore or the big bond houses like PIMCO, just ruthlessly and systematically taking advantage of inefficiencies. So do you think that's right? And what kind of opportunities are there in systematic fixed income or credit or government bonds? Where are the opportunities here?
Lots of opportunities there. I would say that, generally speaking, equities are noisier than fixed income. They have more uncertainty in them because, again, going back to the valuation framework, the price of an equity today depends on the discount rate, but also on the expected future cash flows. And those cash flows are highly uncertain. In fixed income, the cash flows are known, except if there is like some call option, for example, or some probability of default, obviously, on the bond. But excluding those types of events or possibilities, the coupon structure, you know, the face value at the end. So it's relatively easy to price the bond. And then a lot of the movement in prices of the bonds can be directly related to changes in yields, in discount rates. As a result, actually, what happens in fixed income is that that relation between market prices or yields and future expected returns is even stronger, more visible, more reliable, more compelling in empirical studies than in equities. So systematic investing is even more supported empirically, better supported empirically in fixed income. And we've been applying it in the real world for almost 40 years now, successfully showing that this information in current prices does help you invest better. I think we're going to see much more interest in systematic investing in fixed income going into the future. What's important to have as a concern, I would say, is let's hope the factor zoo that happened in equities doesn't move over to the fixed income world. We've already seen many different suggestions of factors that work, quote unquote, in fixed income or are being transferred from the equity markets to the fixed income markets. Motivated by that, we put together a study first on the US market and then globally on the drivers of corporate bond returns, examining a lot of those quote unquote factors that have been proposed as drivers of bond returns, and finding that most of them are actually not related on their own to bond returns. They are fully subsumed by yields and forward rates. So the rumors of lots of factors driving the returns of bonds are highly exaggerated.
Yeah, well, just give it time. I'm sure there'll be a factor zoo in fixed income soon enough. It just takes a bit longer. But I assume as well that obviously in equities, you know, a lot of the execution side has been fully automated and is very systematic itself. And, you know, I've heard all about some machine learning sort of execution strategies to make sure that you time things perfectly, but in a sort of unpredictable way. So, you know, high frequency traders don't pick you off. But in fixed income, and especially in some corners of fixed income, I'm guessing the execution is hard to systematize entirely. So the systematic part is the construction side or the design side, and then the actual construction or the execution side, that still is sort of hand-to-hand combat with dealers. Is that right?
You're right, Robin. While I'm not a bond trader, we do talk with our bond traders a lot. And now that we are starting to develop our offering in fixed income SMAs and trying to apply the technology and streamlining that we are applying on the equity SMA side, realizing that it won't be possible to apply the same streamlining on the fixed income side, in particular in the municipal bond market, which is popular selection for SMAs, as you can do with equity trading. There's still a lot of dealer to dealer, you know, buyer to seller conversations and confirmations going across that are happening. And it's probably going to take much longer for a fixed income market, especially some areas of the fixed income market like muni bonds to get more streamlined and automated. There is much easier trading when it comes, obviously, and much more automated trading when it comes to treasuries and corporate bonds. So hopefully other areas of fixed income catch up as well.
I know a lot of systematic researchers are wary of prognosticating, but if you were to get your crystal ball out And beyond some of the changes on distribution, whether it's separately managed accounts or direct indexing and ETFs and systematic fixed income, which I think is tremendously exciting, what we're going to see in the next 5-10 years there. How do you think quantitative trading investing is going to evolve over the next 10 years, 20 years? What's the future going to look like for your industry?
You named some of the major trends, meaning evolution of delivery formats, personalization. I mentioned ESG investing is going to grow in the systematic space, and then systematic fixed income as another broad trend. I think these are probably the big broad trends, as well as maybe more attention to the importance of thoughtful implementation when it comes to systematic investing. Not just there's a lot of focus on factors, weighting schemas, but there's much more to implementation than that. What happens after the day-to-day in your portfolio? Are you leaving money on the table by not thinking efficiently about the execution of corporate actions, proxy voting, et cetera? So I think there will be probably more research on that and more focus on that down the road when it comes to systematic investing.
So it's a bit like anybody can follow a recipe from a master chef, but it's all about how you execute the ingredients together. That's the real magic.
Yeah. And from a person who has tried several recipes on different things and usually not succeeded in getting the nice end product that you expect. Yes, absolutely. It's very hard. That's what we are really good, I believe, at Dimensional. But most people just, it's kind of under the hood, the successful execution, very hard to calculating basis points, how much comes from this and that, because it's all together in an integrated process, ideally. And so hard to quantify, but important to have.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to show you pictures of my Thanksgiving meal last time I tried to do that. That was an embarrassing mess. So no MasterChef here in this family, unfortunately. There are actually quite a lot of students that watch this podcast as well. And I'd love to hear, you know, what advice you'd give a young Savina, you know, 20, 30 years ago, or anybody else who thinks basically that artisanal active management is going the way of the dodo, and I better quant up because systematic investing is the way of the future. What advice would you give people that want to get into your field today?
I would say study a lot in terms of prepare yourself from theoretical, like finance perspective, but also econometrics. There are a lot of research out there that seems very fancy, but when you dig under the hood, you realize that it's not so robust. And so being able to scrutinize research and understand what's strong and what's weak, the only way you can do this is by understanding the mechanics of that research and the assumptions made, the statistical approaches used and how robust they are. So this applies even to more nascent areas of asset pricing related to machine learning, as you mentioned. You have to understand what's happening under the hood.
That sounds like pretty good advice for institutional investors as well, to be honest.
Agreed. And that's kind of one of the roles I see for our research department at Dimensional, honestly, is not just to help improve the investment solutions we have and launch new investment solutions for our clients, be innovative on that front, but also be the voice of reason in the industry in terms of what's robust, what's reliable, and what's not.
So essentially, there's a lot of noise in the broader financial research community, and you think you can bring a bit more signal to that and maybe help elucidate certain areas.
Yeah, and a bit of intellectual honesty and rigor. Yeah.
Finally, though, who's your favorite driver? You must have one.
I used to be a big fan of Alonso, but now my husband is a big fan of Lewis Hamilton. So I kind of root for both of them, Alonso and Hamilton. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Okay, two. I'll give you that at least. Okay, well, maybe I need to look at Formula One through fresh eyes now, through quant eyes, and I'll enjoy it a little bit more then.
Definitely. Yes.
Well, Savina, thanks so much for doing this. And it was great catching up. I hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you, Robin. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.